Well, isn't it great to be led in worship music by our kids and our young adults? Isn't that fabulous? Wasn't that great? Yeah, I loved it too. And they sing the songs that I can sing. I love it, you know? I mean, thank you. And so much work has been done, and they sounded just particularly good this morning. And thank you so much. Particularly enjoyed Katie on the electric guitar. Might indicate my age, right? I really liked that. Yes, thank you. Thank you. What's wrong with the world? What's wrong with the world? I'm going to ask you that question. I want some responses. I went to a Reddit page, just probably because I was bored standing in line somewhere, and asked that question. You know, there's a whole discussion page on Reddit on what's wrong with the world. Here are some of the answers. Kind of think about whether you like some of these or not. Lack of critical thinking. Lack of education. Egotistical leaders. Bad parenting. Capitalism. Social media, boomers, individualism, too much concrete, right? We are disconnected from the divine, corruption, religion or ideology, bad people. I love this one. The problem with the world, most everybody in the world is good, but we have these bad people. And they cause most of all of our problems. And if we could just figure out who they are, you know. All right. You guys are church people. You've read the Bible. What's wrong with the world? That's good. Sin, who said that? Love it. Okay. Sin. Anyone else? What's wrong with the world? Give me some flesh on this sin idea.
Selfishness.
Selfishness. Okay. Anyone? Sin. What is sin? Sin is? Falling short of God. Okay. Ever heard of sin is breaking God's law? But that's not the whole story. Separation. All right. This is what Paul writes. We are hostile to God. That's the problem. Okay? The mind governed by the flesh is hostile to God. It does not submit to God's law, nor can it do so. We are enemies. We are opposed to God. Okay? Yeah. That, in biblical terms, is what's wrong with the world. The truth about humanity is we are adversarial to God. We are opposed to God, you know? And that's what Paul says propositionally, as a propositional truth. The gospel writers depict that narratively. Have you ever spent some time just reading the arrest, trial, and crucifixion of Jesus? There's a lot of hostility, right? There's a lot of hostility. Let's look at that a little bit in Mark. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the teachers of the law came together. And what I notice about that sentence is those people don't usually agree on much. You have the Herodians, they get to be the religious rulers because they get to be the religious rulers. They're in charge, they got the power, how'd they get that way? Not very legitimately, but it doesn't matter because it's a settled question now. Sadducees, they're in with the Herodians, the religious rulers. Pharisees, those are your Bible teachers. It says teachers of the law, that's what they're talking about. So you get together all faith people of all stripes in one place. You know what they can agree on? Killing Jesus. That's the only thing they can agree on. And this is what the Gospel of Mark writes. They condemned him as worthy to death. Then some began to spit him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and they said, "Prophesy." And the guards took him and beat him. Does that sound like religious people of faith to you? That's what the faith people did. That's how they reacted to Jesus. Why? Did Jesus ever do anything to provoke that level of anger? You see, he said things. He said outrageous things. He said things like he was going to replace the temple. He said things like he's the Messiah, the anointed of God. He said things like he is the Son of Man depicted in Daniel who will return on the clouds of glory and put everything right in this world. He said that. And it was true. Here was God made flesh. The immortal, the unreachable, the God that we can never get at and can never see, he became mortal, he became killable. So what did we do? We killed him. Because we're quite angry with God. Because we're opposed to God. Because we are oppositional to God. He claimed to be the Son of Man, the Lord of the Sabbath. He claimed to have the power to forgive sin. And normally when people claim to be God, do you know what we do with them? Well, Lenny right now is downtown claiming to be God. Do you know what we do with Lenny? Lenny has mental health issues, right? We get help for Lenny. We don't kill Lenny. The world has always had those people. He made these claims and they were credible. He made these claims and they were believable. He was God. And we're angry with God. That's the truth about humanity. It's not just true about people of faith. It's also true about Gentiles. Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barnabas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed over to be crucified. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is the praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him, then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him, and they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again they struck him on the head with a staff and spit at him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him, and they mocked him. And they took off the purple robe and put on his own clothes, and they led him out to be crucified. God is mocked, God is beaten, God is tortured, God is murdered. The ruling class wants Jesus dead. The working class wants Jesus dead. The religious leaders want Jesus dead. The secular leaders want Jesus dead. The crowd wants Jesus dead. Every class, every nationality, every religious viewpoint, everybody hates God and wants him dead. Paul is right. We hate God and we want him dead. While we were enemies, Christ died for us. You know, there's a lot of people, they'll say, "Listen, I don't have that strong opinion. I mean, I probably don't believe in God, but I don't hate God." But you do, right? It's not just disbelief that's the problem. We're mad at God, violently mad. Now, does this apply to us? Does this apply to you and I sitting in the pew today? We're preparing for communion. I want you to look inside of your heart, because here is the truth. Before you were converted, you were hostile to God and you were against God. And the voice of those people mocking God at his trial is in you. If you look deeply within yourself, you will still find it there. That's what Paul writes. How does that work? You know, I used to do some work as a divorce lawyer, and I used to get these things called custody evaluation reports. As I've said in this congregation many times, 80% of the time I represented mom for reasons I do not know. But that's what I did. I represented mom mostly in divorce cases. And, I get these custody evaluation reports because we had to determine what the custody and visitation arrangement was going to be, and we just couldn't agree on it. So we'd jointly hire a psychologist, and the psychologist would do a forensic report. Would interview mom, interview dad, do this testing in those days called the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, and create these reports. And then I'd get these reports, and I'd read these reports with my client. And a lot of times, the client would not believe things that the psychologist found as fact. One of the facts I remember in this one report was, I represented mom, and the psychologist found this as a fact. She hates her father. Really? Her own father. And that's going to present issues because she's not going to be supportive of the divorcing father, the ex-husband, having a relationship with the children. So mom said, I can't believe he said that. I can't. What is with this guy? So we went back and I got to question the psychologist. So why did you come to this position? Well, didn't my client tell you that she loved her father? Yes, she told me that. Do you think she was lying to you when she said it? No. I believe she believes she loves her father. Well, what led you to this conclusion? Well, she also told me that her parents divorced when she was 14, that her father had had an affair that led to the divorce, and that she hasn't seen her father in 3 years, and her father calls every month, but she lets the call go to voicemail and does not talk to her father. And it's been over a year since she's talked to her father. And she also told me she loves her father. I said, please explain this to me. He goes, this is in the literature. This is in the litter. The things that are so close to our identity, we deny. We suppress the truth. Let me tell you something, church people. There's a voice inside of you that is oppositional to God. And it's hard to come to terms with and realize and get it out on the table. Because God is also very close to who you are and how you identify yourself. Like this mother in this custody evaluation report. I remember after reading that report, I came to Sabbath school where I kind of learned this principle. I've been teaching in Sabbath school in this church since 1996. Sometimes we get some hard stories, hard Bible stories. And I remember one Sabbath, it had to have been like 20 years ago, where we got this story about Uzzah and the Ark. Anybody know that story? King David, newly crowned king, not king that long, decides to return the Ark to its rightful place in Jerusalem. It has been in Bela, or whatever, an outskirts town on the edge of the Philistine Empire and the beginning of Judah. So he gets some trusted men together, and they go, and they put the ark on an ox cart. And one of his trusted men is Uzzah. And so they're taking the ark to Jerusalem on an ox cart. The ox stumbles, and Uzzah, being a helpful guy, puts his hand out to stop the ark from falling off the cart, and the wrath of the Lord strikes out against Uzzah, and he is immediately dead. That was the story. You get a story like that in Sabbath school, and you get various reactions, including reactions like this. I don't believe in a God of wrath. I believe God is a loving God, and I don't think that is what happened in that story. I am not accepting that God or that story. And so I say, well, okay, tell me about your God. My God is a loving God. My God would never act that way. Okay. So what you're telling me is you've created a God in your own mind, and he lives up to your standards. He agrees with you. He holds the same opinions you hold, the same values you hold, and that's God. How do you feel about the God of the Bible? I hate that guy. Right? Can we put that guy on trial for this? That is totally misbehavior. That's a misdeed. Now, one way we avoid this issue is by creating a God in our own mind. Look inside yourself before you take communion and see if your voice exists among those who call for God to be tried, beaten, and executed. Most every Christian, there's so many Christian poets and writers and so forth, and at some level they will embrace this idea, I crucified Jesus. It's not my idea. Listen to the hymn. I heard my own voice calling out among the mockers. Isn't that a hymn that we sing? Or I like my favorite one, Bono. I was there when they crucified my Lord. I held the scabbard as the soldier drew his sword. I rolled the dice as they pierced his side. But I've seen love conquer the great divide. Point two, another hard truth. God's wrath is upon us. What is God's wrath? Man's wrath against God, we've been talking about. God's wrath on humanity is about God's settled judicial judgment. It works like this. Say there are rebellious people who decided to violently overthrow the government. And the government was led by a king, maybe King George. If King George, in defense of his government, which he was legitimately in charge of, sent out a decree saying all the rebels who are seeking to violently overthrow the government should be put to death, that would be the king's wrath. And God's wrath is the same way. It's a judicial decree against the rebellious God haters. And it is depicted in the Garden of Gethsemane. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he told them. "Stay here and keep watch." Going a little further, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Yet, not what I will, but what you will." Now, overwhelmed to the point of death and sorrow. This is a Greek word right here, ekthembeo. It's translated there as deeply distressed. Ekthembeo. But its real meaning is to be suddenly thrown into terror. The way you would use this Greek word in a sentence is like this. I was walking to my parents' house to see my parents. I turned the corner and encountered my mother's decapitated body. What word would you do to explain what happened in that moment? Ekthembeo. Well, it's beyond deeply distressed, right? It's a sudden terror. This is what happened to Jesus in the garden, ekthembeo, right? Going a little farther, he fell to the ground and he said, "Let this cup pass from me." Now, that's a literal translation. It's pretty good. It says, "Take this cup." That's what it literally says. The problem is that our culture has changed. In American culture, if somebody is sentenced to death, what happens? They go to the electric chair. They go to the gallows. Death by lethal injection. Okay. A better translation would be, "Take this electric chair from me." A judicial decision has been made, and you're being put to death. That's the cup. The way the ancients would have a judicial proceeding and decide that a crime was worthy of death, and then it would be death by drinking a cup of wine with nerve agent in it. Think of Socrates. Socrates was convicted of the crime of corrupting the youth. He was sentenced to death by drinking the cup. That's what this language is. It explains why during his rest, Jesus shows no emotion. The temple guard comes to arrest him, and his reaction is, "Am I leading a rebellion that you come to arrest me with swords and clubs?" Jesus is calm, always in control. His captors have overreacted. During his trial, witnesses come forward and give false testimony against him. He did not open his mouth. They blindfolded him, hit him, spit him with their fists. No reaction, no words. Self-controlled, self-contained. Before Pilate, the accusations are repeated. No reply. Soldiers put a crown of thorns on his head. They spit at him and strike him with a club. No reaction at all. He's offered wine mixed with myrrh, an ancient painkiller. He refuses the painkiller. 9 a.m., they nail him to a cross. No emotion. The wrath of man does not scare Jesus. Contrast that with the garden. My soul is overwhelmed. I am horrified. Okay, what is this? What is the cup? Cup, a metaphor for divine justice poured out on injustice. Right? It's depicted several places in the Bible, including a Seventh-day Adventist favorite text. They too will drink the wine of God's fury, which has been poured out full strength into the cup of his wrath, and they will be tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels, a judicial decree against those who hate God and would kill him all over again. I must tell you that I have struggled too with the idea of a loving God and a God of wrath. But I had an experience this summer where it suddenly kind of came home for me. I want to tell you about it. I had it with Annika. And we're also going to serve communion and take communion, because we're going to end on a happy note, and that is, he made peace by the blood of his lamb. I mean, you can see the war, right? Man's wrath against God, God's wrath. So how's the peace? The peace, the cup, is the cup, the communion cup, and by his blood we are reconciled. And so that's where we're going to end, and I'd ask the deacons to come up and serve. I'm going to finish my talk and tell you the personal story about how I came to understand that a loving God would also have to get angry. I went to Auschwitz this summer. Annika and I went to Auschwitz this summer. We went to Poland. We had a lovely trip together. It was a great time, daughter and father, and a lot of history. Both Annika and I love history. So we go to Auschwitz, and of course they show you the shoes, and they tell you about all the thousands and tens of thousands of people that came down those train tracks from all parts of Europe, Eastern Europe mostly, Romania, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland. They came down those train tracks to a dead end, and there's no village, there's no town. 1.1 million people got deported to this place, and a village, a town, never really grew up beyond about 10 or 20,000. What happened was they were stripped naked. They left their shoes and their luggage. They thought they were being deported to be held in a camp, much like the Americans did with the Japanese. But that's not what happened. Instead, they were murdered in the shower stalls with Zyklon B, and then their bodies were burned, stacked up like cordwood, one after another, and burned in those ovens right there, more than 1 million people in a period of 2.5 years. And we get told all the stories, including the individual stories, very meticulous at Auschwitz, that you get to know the names and the faces. They put their pictures on the wall. They speak their names. It's quite a day. But what I can tell you about this day is at the end of it, I decided I had a bunch of pictures about all the evidence and all the atrocities that happened in this place, and I didn't have a single picture with my daughter. So I insisted that Annika and I take a picture together, that we were here, we were at Auschwitz. And so here's my selfie, and you see that fool right there smiling? Okay? And Annika is just absolutely mad at me, like you wouldn't believe. Dad, you better not smile. What are you thinking, breaking a smile in a place like this? And she's right. Because the opposite of love is not wrath. It's not anger. It's not being upset. The opposite of love is indifference. It's no emotional reaction. We have a God of love and also a God of wrath, and they have to go together because you can't care deeply about humans and their creation and their fate in this world without getting angry and without wanting a decree of justice at some point. Some point, justice has got to be decreed. Well, as I told you, this sermon ends with this text, which is the great text about absolutely everything. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body of the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him and through him be reconciled to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Once you were alienated from God, you were enemies in your mind because of your evil behavior, but now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death, to present you holy in his sight without blemish and free from accusation. Amen. This is the total and complete description of reality. In him all things were created. He was fully God. He was fully God when they tortured him, when they mocked him, when they beat him, when they killed him. He is before all things. He has existed prior and has always existed and will always exist. And he did not exist for a period of Friday 3 p.m. to Sunday morning because he chose to become killable. And in him all things hold together. Can you feel how adversarial this world is? How everything is flying apart? Democrats don't get along with Republicans. Now Republicans don't get along with Republicans. Atheists don't get along with Christians. Christians don't get along with atheists. Anti-vaxxers don't get along with vaxxers, and vaxxers don't like anti-vaxxers. Mutual hatred is on the rise. More people are identifying themselves not as Methodists and Baptists and Roman Catholics, but as Republicans or Democrats. And the only thing bringing us together is a common experience of getting to hate people together. If we could only vanquish those evil people waving a different banner, we'd be on the road to national recovery. And I think of that, and that let's identify the bad people and get rid of the bad people and say, isn't that the final solution? You know, isn't that what happened? And so everything is in a partisan state of flying apart. But God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him and through him reconcile himself to all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Does everybody have a cup? I know, you missed me, Patrick. It's all right. And so we'll take communion. And the Lord declared, and he passed out to his followers a piece of bread, but he broke it first. And he says, "This is my body. Take and eat." And he took a cup, and he says, "This is the new covenant. This is my blood poured out for many. Do this in remembrance of me." And by drinking this cup, we remember we will all day one day be united at his table, at a feast, at a banquet, where we will all raise cups together. And we remember that as well. May the peace of Christ be upon you as you leave this building today. May you be reconciled in all of your relationships and all things in Christ Jesus. Amen.